I'm going to call this meeting of the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from Monday, March 24th. Is there anyone who has read and would like to move approval of the minutes? Vice Chair Lee has moved approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The first bill on the agenda is House File 2418. Representative Tabke, welcome back to the committee. You're getting to be a regular here. So I will move that House File 2418 be referred to the Capital Investment Committee. Is that where you would like it to go? Okay, so
sir.
So moved. Please present your bill, Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I really appreciate being back here in the GovOps side of Election GovOps right now. We have a bill today that started back in 2019 with Chair Fu Lee and myself having talked about how bonding bills move forward and what happens with them and making sure that all the bonding projects that are capital investment projects that are funded and built are then maintained correctly so that in 20 years, 30 years down the road, those are not coming back to the state for more money simply for maintenance purposes and making sure that there is a maintenance plan in place for all of these projects. So it's the idea is patterned off of what we did while I was mayor in Shakopee for making sure that we have a plan in place and a maintenance plan for making sure that all those things happen. And so there was a bill that came through last year that Chair Lee had that had a fund that was in place and setting aside money for capital maintenance. And so we have he gave the bill to me this year. And so we, in conjunction with Chair Lee, working with the League of Minnesota Cities, counties, small cities, and other entities on this bill, we have changed it so that it is a capital maintenance plan. And so there's some things that we still need to tweak and work out with this DE, but that is what it does. It sets up a capital maintenance plan, and it requires that at future times when people come back to the state for more bonding capital investment money, that they are following the plan for the projects that are currently in process. And so with that, that's the DE3 amendment that to 2418, and happy to answer questions. We also have testified.
Sure. I apologize. I probably should have moved. Would you like me to move the DE3 amendment to
yes,
get
please.
In the shape you'd like? Okay. I will move the DE3 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to your testifier, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and honorable members of the committee. My name is Bill Reynolds. I'm the city administrator for Shakopee. I've been there for about 10 years. I bring you greetings from the city, and which is one of the lowest tax communities in the state and a thriving epicenter of innovation, entertainment, and growth. I am delighted to briefly share with you part of our history of innovation, the establishment of a capital project plan, and internal service funds which provide for a known process, timeline, and resources for major purchases and replacement, but also overall stability in our tax rates. Most cities have a capital improvement plan, but in Shakopee, this plan not only contains future activities, but includes future maintenance and operational costs, as well as estimated replacement costs, and most importantly, a funding mechanism for that replacement. This funding mechanism is encapsulated in four internal service funds that are reviewed annually as part of our budget process. All of these funds are financed by internal rental payments paid to each one of these funds by city departments at rates established by the Finance Committee during the budgeting process, with the purpose being to ensure funds are available to replace the items in question. The four funds are the Equipment Fund, the Building Fund, the Park Asset Fund, the IT Fund, and these names are pretty bland, but what they have allowed us to do is to have the funds on hand to make any necessary major purchases, replacements that we need without large swings in our property taxes. Imagine you are a member of a city council and you need to replace a fire engine at the tune of approximately $1.5 million. In our case, each 1% rise in property taxes over the last year covers about $225,000, meaning that we would need to raise the tax levy this year about 5.5% just to be able to purchase this needed piece of equipment. This doesn't even begin to address the myriad of other needs of the city. This is a big deal, and that is why many cities put off these decisions after much anguish in the deliberative process. If you do go ahead and approve that purchase, the impact on your residents' tax bills for that particular year will be quite significant. In Shakopee, frankly, it's a consent item. There is no impact on our tax bill because we've already got the funds in place. That, in a nutshell, is why this is such an important process for our city. Having a replacement plan in place with designated funding allows us to do what is required with less. We can buy the equipment, rebuild facilities, parks, trails, and ensure we have up-to-date information technology without the major impact such large actions can have on our property taxes. It also has a secondary benefit of reducing the angst of our elected officials and staff as we try to find ways to pay for things that we may or may not have. We don't have to worry about that. In addition, it is an efficient use of time as well. All of those major discussions on how are we going to pay for that are largely reduced or completely eliminated, allowing us to save our political capital, if you will, on other issues in our community. So let's take a very quick look at these funds. So the equipment fund was established in 1984 and finances the purchase of large equipment such as cars, trucks, graders, loaders, tractors, and larger lawnmowers and other equipment costing $20,000 or more. The building fund was established in 1998 and expanded in 2000 and 2008. It covers the purchase, construction, major reconstruction, and additions to city-owned buildings, including the City Hall, Library, Public Works Building, and police and fire stations. The Park Asset Fund was created in 2007 and finances the updating and replacement of park assets such as playgrounds, trails, courts, major landscaping, and parking. And finally, the Information Technology Fund was created in 2010 and finances the replacement and acquisition of information technology, including computers, printers, copiers, and network items. All of these issues, when they come up before the City Council, already have a funding stream. As you can see, we did not establish all these funds at once, and we have tweaked them over the years. But what they have done for us as a city is to ensure that we have the necessary means to keep up our major equipment and internal infrastructure. As I noted in the beginning, these funds are not static, but the rents are adjusted yearly in order to ensure that we are keeping up with inflation and other impacts on the costs of individual items. On occasion, but not a lot, the City of Shakopee comes before the legislature and asks for bonding funds. In our case, you can be assured that we will not ask for funds later or for major renovations or replacements of the original. We already have that taken care of. Representative Tapke's bill, which essentially requires cities to plan, is a best practice and simply good business. It alleviates this body from worrying about funding the same project over and over, while providing a benefit to cities they may not recognize until they are required to think about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. I have three people who signed up to testify. First is Craig Johnson, then Capel Rourke, then Nathan Jessen. And if you could limit your testimony to 2 or 3 minutes, we'd appreciate it. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committees, my name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities and honored to be here today to make a few comments on the bill as it is amended. So League of Minnesota Cities, for those who are not as familiar, is the statewide association of cities. We have 856 cities in the state of Minnesota. 841 of them are members of the league. The 15 that aren't are all under 200 in population, and if they call us, we still answer the phone, but they don't need our services on a regular basis. So we do try to look at legislation like this and see where it would apply to cities and how it works. And we've been working with Chair Lee, the Senate Chair, and others on this issue for a number of years now. Very much appreciate the amendment that was put forward today. It does move in a direction that we have been working on for quite some time. I want to be clear that our understood intent of this matches pretty well with what we believe the author and other legislators have been trying to get, which is when we have projects that have not gone through state agency processes for evaluating readiness for a project and funding and financing, which the state pots do on their own. So items that are direct appropriations or earmarks, if you will, that there is some sort of system in place for knowing how the community plans to maintain that infrastructure that the state is helping to create. And it is an essential part of the state-local partnership that we keep that relationship strong so that local communities who cannot afford to do these projects without some state assistance still have that capacity. But we do recognize that there is a responsibility to show that you're ready to manage that resource. And we do feel that there is a way to do that and that this is moving in the right direction. A couple of quick comments on the legislation. We do think there is still some work that will need to be done as this moves in the legislative process. We need to make sure that we're not having any unintended repercussions on projects that could be blocked or significantly slowed by this that we weren't meaning to include. So we'll be working with the authors and with the Capital Investment Committee and with the state agencies that are responsible for running the programs that get money out to communities to make sure we're not missing anything there and causing any problems. Obviously, the details on the certification of the plan and what the plan has to require still need to be worked out, and so does how soon can we get that figured out to a reasonable level so that we can have the enactment date match up well with when the product will be ready to be used. So with that, Mr. Chair, we are comfortable with the direction this language is moving. We will continue to work with the legislature to get it to work well, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cap O'Rourke. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Association of Small Cities. We advocate on behalf of the over 700 cities that have populations under 5,000. I want to thank Representative Tabke for his work on this bill. It is a significant improvement over with the DE amendment over the way it originally was. Our biggest concern is a lot of times with small cities are the typical types of capital projects that we use and we see are truly need-based, often wastewater infrastructure, drinking water infrastructure, and the concept of, and we already, by getting these state funds, often already show or establish that we are at the levying limit that the state accepts. So having to originally set aside money was just going to be significantly problematic for a lot of our cities. We support fully the concept of having plans in place. I think, like Mr. Gustafson said, we want to make sure that there aren't unintended consequences. I also want to make sure on behalf of small cities who often have very limited staff to do all the work of their larger city brethren that they are able to submit these plans and they are easy enough and workable with the state agencies to do so. But I think we like the way this policy is going now, and I think it'll make for good policies for both cities and the state. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Next is Nathan Jessen. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Jessen. I represent the Minnesota Intercounty Association. It's an organization of 17 of the most populous counties in Minnesota after Hennepin and Ramsey. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to testify and thank Representative Tabke for his work on the bill. The conversations we've had have been really productive, and I do think, as Mr. Johnson said, the DE is really helpful in clarifying the intent of this bill. And we share the goals of trying to make sure that infrastructure in the state of Minnesota is in the best place it can be for now and in the long term. But similar to earlier comments from my city brethren, we just want to make sure that there's not more being looped into these requirements than being intended. And we just especially just want to look at like that definition of capital project on 1.6 and 1.7 to make sure that if the focus is on director appropriations that we try to keep it in that realm. So happy to answer any questions, but wanted to thank the committee for the time.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we can go to member discussion. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tacky, just a quick question. So like in my area, there's five communities that are doing the Zumbro wastewater facility, and maybe this is a question for Mr. O'Rourke, but do we believe that then with this plan, is that going to cause problems when we're working with, you know, multiple people that are all, you know, getting the same, their grantees, their multiple grantees?
Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Altendorf. So this would not apply to those types of projects. It would just apply to direct appropriations. Most likely, the water treatment plants and things like that fall under they already have a separate plan that's already put up saying that they will be charging X amount and make sure that they have a maintenance plan put together. So this wouldn't apply to those that already have a separate piece going forward.
Representative Altendorf.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so take that example out. But there are a lot of, don't you see a lot of times that different towns are working together and that there would be an overlap? Do you ever see that being a problem or you don't think that's a problem at all?
Representative Tapke.
Mr. Chair and Representative Altendorf. So there's an agency that whoever the grantee is, so the grantee definition on D 1.9 through 1.11, the grantee, which is not a state agency or a state official, is whomever is receiving that funding. So usually it's going to go to an entity, so a city or a town or a county, and whoever that is that's getting the money is there.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any additional member discussion? Okay. Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Tapke?
No, I think this is a really good thing that will help make sure that our state money is getting put to good use when it goes to local entities. Not that it isn't anyway, but we're making sure that that is viable and going well into the future. So I just appreciate everyone's support, and we'll move on and continue to make changes, continue working on this to make it better so that it meets everybody's needs.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2418 as amended be referred to the Capital Investment Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Your bill's on its way, Representative Tapke. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it.
Representative Ray Rauer, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 1209 be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. So House File 1299 is a bill that comes from my personal experience as a Coon Rapids City Council member for the 4 years previous to this. During my tenure, I witnessed effective organizations that had the funding and they had the ability to create quality emergency shelters and then to get rejected by a majority vote of the council. In your packets, there are handouts that show the specifics. So the first is shows a location that Family Promise wanted to purchase in order to build family temporary housing. As you can see from the handout, the property is along busy University Avenue, is bordered on the northern side by office zoning, on the southern side by commercial zoning, and all around behind it by multifamily housing. This would have been an excellent location for an emergency shelter. Unfortunately, the council voted down the necessary zoning change, and therefore Family Promise had to go back to the drawing board. And they did eventually find another location where the zoning was more flexible, but this delayed the project by over 3 years. We also had in Coon Rapids a current Anoka County Commissioner, former Executive Director of Stepping Stone Emergency Housing, Julie Jepson, present in January of 2022 an opportunity for Stepping Stone, and that's this location in your handout, to purchase, remodel, and update a hotel in our city and expand their services there. It required a zoning change, which was again voted down by the majority of the council. This hotel would have been a great location for emergency shelter. It had walkable access to Metro Transit Hub, walkable access to Atlas staffing. So one of the concerns voiced by the council at this time and why they voted these down was that if they changed their zoning to allow for emergency housing in Coon Rapids would end up with too many shelters, while neighboring cities and suburbs around it could continue not to have any. So this bill, my bill, would help with situation like this. It allows for emergency shelters in commercial, industrial, and multifamily zoning districts. All cities would then be on an even playing field. Currently, they're not. The dispersal of emergency shelters is not even. There's a much higher capacity per capita, so per person, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and these two cities are often taking in folks from their surrounding suburbs. For example, Minneapolis has approximately one bed for 530 people, whereas in Anoka County, there's one bed per 3,500 people. Finally, there are very few shelters outside the metro, and often the only bed for someone there is in the county jail. We have 198 homeless veterans on the Homeless Veteran Registry, so this bill would also be one piece of many actions that would help move in the direction of ending veteran homelessness. So, Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers with me today, and I'd like to turn it over to them. I have Matt Trainer, who is Director of Advocacy and Interim Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and then my second testifier is David Fry, Executive Director of Family Promise, which I spoke about previously in my testimony.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Hello, Chair Quam, Chair Freiberg, and committee members. My name is Matt Trainer, Interim Executive Director of the Coalition for the Homeless, also known as MCH. I'm testifying in support of the bill, 1299. We're a statewide organization that's dedicated to advocating for policies and resources to end homelessness. We have over 70 members across the state, and just so you know, we receive zero of the funds that we advocate for. I just want to state that so you know our only self-interest is ensuring that everyone has a place to call home. To start, I'd like to share that we understand preemption is politically challenging. We work closely with counties and cities to ensure we're aware of their concerns, and from time to time, we can agree to disagree, and this may just be one of those times, but with no hard feelings. So there's been so much talk about holding nonprofits accountable, but we also have to do the same for other entities because not everyone knows the best way to approach homelessness. There have been multiple cities in Minnesota who have passed ordinances criminalizing homelessness, even though this has been proven to be ineffective. Homelessness is very complex, and when we know best practices, we need to standardize them. Expanding where shelters can be developed is one of those best practices. Without a sudden and almost impossible influx of housing, we're going to need shelters. No matter a person's motivation, I also believe nobody here really wants to see people living outside. By increasing where shelters can be zoned, House File 1299 will help everyone because you can't ignore, you can't criminalize, or zone out homelessness. Shelter providers are facing significant challenges, which is only getting heightened in our federal and state financial situations. While this bill may seem like it's telling local governments how to do their jobs, it's giving more flexibility for local organizations who are the experts to respond to homelessness by developing shelters at locations they have identified. In 2023, at MCH and our partners, we were able to secure $100 million in shelter capital funding, but there is almost $370 million in requests across the state. And 45% of the funding of those requests were from Greater Minnesota, and 50% of the funding awards went to Greater Minnesota. This just shows that we're facing a crisis in every part of the state, and we need to do everything we can to ensure people are at least able to stay indoors with services provided. Thanks for hearing me. Please support House File 1299 because shelter saves lives and housing ends homelessness. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony and welcome to the committee. I assume based on the spelling of your name and the spelling of my name that you pronounce your last name Fry.
That's true. Yes.
Does anyone ever call you Frytag by any chance? You don't have to answer that. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for taking the time today. My name is David Fry. I am the executive director for Family Promise in Anoka County. We are a nonprofit organization that has been serving families experiencing homelessness in our community for 15 years. We started as a network of churches who provided the overnight shelter, accommodations, food, and hospitality for families in our community. But saw that that was a very difficult program for families who were experiencing the program and also lacked the capacity that we needed in Anoka County to deal with families who are unhoused experiencing homelessness. To that end, we began the work of looking to create permanent shelter in Anoka County. And so in 2018, when we started the process of finding a location for our family shelter, we quickly discovered there was no straightforward answer on where we could locate space. There was no place that we could go that would tell us where was available and where was not to be able to start working with the local governments to find our place. Further, we found that in many municipalities, this lack of explicit allowance in the zoning code meant that it was a blanket rejection for us to locate anywhere in their city, even though they experienced rates of homelessness that we could have helped. This was a wall that we ran into over and over, trying and failing in 7 different locations over the years to find a much-needed space for our shelter, all while the need in our community continued to grow. The shelter need across the state is large, and the zoning hurdle is one of the highest barriers for organizations like ours. Ultimately, at Family Promise, we were able to make our project work by separating out housing from our full-time offices and putting those on adjacent properties, effectively creating a campus model that allowed us to avoid rezoning and special use permits. We are breaking ground this spring on our second phase of that recently, so we're very excited for that. The project has worked for us, and this campus model can work for some, but for many organizations, it won't. It could be unworkable for a lot of people that are working with individuals and maybe in other certain situations as well, too. It also is something that the zoning issues put us at a disadvantage for many years, while many families who could have been served went unserved over that time. The current zoning in most locations across the state effectively means that shelter is, for the most part, procedurally outlawed. The unsheltered population continues to grow, and if we want to even come close to meeting the need, we need to start to remove the roadblocks that prevent our state's shelter capacity from meeting the needs of Minnesotans. A statewide change would simplify the process for each city, in my mind. The experience we had with the city staff and city council in Coon Rapids, who recognized the need for shelter and was ready and willing to work with us, but voiced concern about what would happen if they opened up their zoning while other surrounding communities did not, meant that we were unable to continue with our originally planned model for shelter. A statewide change would remove this limitation and allow for shelter to be spread out more evenly throughout the communities instead of concentrated in just the few places that allow it. I think the potential to drive innovation in the shelter space and to put families and individuals' experience first comes with the flexibility offered by this bill as well. Currently, it's difficult. The difficulty of sourcing a location and getting it approved leads to larger, more concentrated spaces, which are often less ideal for the families or individuals participating in those programs and also have a higher impact on the neighborhoods in which they're located. This change could allow for much smaller community-oriented spaces that would offer better outcomes for the participants of the programs and a much lower impact on the communities. Our project at Family Promise aims to focus on the idea that the children in the program won't even know that their family is in a homelessness program. We believe that the same thing could be true, that the neighbors won't even know that this is a homeless shelter. They won't even have to recognize that project is going on in their neighborhood. We also think that this has the potential for lowering costs for organizations like ours who are creating and running shelter programs, and it does not add costs to Minnesota taxpayers. So thank you for your time and hearing my testimony. I hope that you will consider this bill as an opportunity to expand the services for families in need in our state, and will serve the most vulnerable Minnesotans.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Fry. So then the one testifier who signed up is Daniel Lightfoot. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League, as this committee knows, represents the collective interests of our 841 member cities across the state of Minnesota. First of all, I want to call out Representative Ray Rauer and her two testifiers in the great work that they do to address housing instability and homelessness in our communities. Mr. Traynor and I have had many a conversation of how to sort of bridge the gap between reasonable local decision-making authority in terms of time, place, and manner for shelters and encampments, as well as balancing that and the best practices for ensuring that individuals experiencing homelessness are adequately housed. And I would say that housing instability and homelessness, despite progress in certain areas, certainly continues to be a growing concern in Minnesota, of course, and in cities across the state. Providing solutions and adequate resources that include shelter capacity to address housing instability and homelessness is, of course, a goal that is shared by Minnesota cities, and cities continue to work diligently to address this important issue through the provision of resources and support to address housing instability and homelessness. While the policy priority of providing more shelter capacity and availability is certainly a shared priority of the League and cities across the state, we do have a few concerns with House File 1299, primarily around local land use planning and zoning authorities and how they are used to balance land use desires of all residents and property owners and to preserve city ability to protect public health, safety, and welfare. In its current form, House File 1299 oversimplifies how cities help site and support emergency shelter facilities in areas that allow for the best outcomes for the residents in need of shelter, namely access to amenities and services, including transit and other services. By allowing shelters by right as a permitted use in most areas without any ability for cities to address size, scale, spacing via conditional use permit, shelters could be forced in incompatible areas that are not suitable for shelters, like heavy industrial areas that not only tend to have the least access to amenities and services, including transit, it could also expose residents to more negative environmental factors in those places. Additionally, the current bill language in House File 1299 includes a definition of emergency housing facilities that is very broad and includes no reference to the type, services provided, size or scale of facility, including any parameters around number of emergency housing units on site, and seems to encompass all possible types of emergency housing facilities, which vary widely and shape how cities ensure the health, safety, and welfare of residents, both in emergency housing based on the type and location of emergency housing. And I would say I appreciate Mr. Trainor's comment that not everyone knows the best ways to support homelessness, and that is absolutely true. And I would also say that not everyone knows how to, in individual communities, address land use and zoning that is unique to those individual community needs. And so I think there is a great opportunity here for us to continue to work together on this bill, on this piece of legislation, to ensure that we are balancing the needs of the shelter capacity needs in this state with also ensuring that those shelters are sited in areas that make the most sense to have the best outcomes for residents in those communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Happy to stand for questions as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we can move to member discussion. There's also an amendment. I don't know if somebody would like to offer that. Representative Davis, looks like you're offering the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer the A1 amendment, and thank you, Mr. Lightfoot, for your testimony. It fits very much with this amendment, and I thank you, Representative Ray Rauer, for bringing forth a bill that helps address the issues with homelessness. We also want best practice health and safety standards to come alongside with this legislation. And so, Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment just allows the creation of a conditional use permit or a special use permit to ensure proper maintenance and operation of a facility. It simply copies language that's already exists in the current subdivision, and that is my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Rehrauer, did you have any comments to the amendment?
I do. So currently nothing in my bill would overrule the city safety, city occupancy, nor the city codes that relate to any of those things. So building codes would still apply, safety codes would still apply. If there were safety concerns, city inspectors could still have access. So for those reasons, I do not support the amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Rehrauer. Representative Quam, or Chair Quam, excuse me.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just confused if this amendment is just clarifying existing normal procedures, why we would want to purposely exclude normal existing procedures from this. Is there a reason why that would be excluded?
Sure. Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, because as of the way the bill is worded currently, there's nothing that would supersede city safety occupancy or codes such as that, so I don't see the need for it. And the way the language is written, it says a city may request the special use permit, which basically means that they could choose to vote down and deny that special use permit. So we'd end up back in the same place where we are now, where a city council could just vote it down, just like they did with these other projects. And that just leads us back to the same place where we're not getting emergency shelters built. However, if I can take 30 more seconds, I do very strongly want to work together, and I would love bipartisan support for the bill, and I'm very happy to work on amendments that wouldn't change my intent of the bill. So things that, was it Mr. Lightfoot, is that right? Mentioned, including, you know, let's say you want to exclude heavy industrial, or maybe there's concerns about would this apply to neighborhoods that are townhomes too, or is it only high density residential? So if we wanted to clarify that, there's plenty of work we could do, and I would love to work together with you to amend it in a way that would be feasible for you.
Thank you, Representative Ray Rauer. And Chair Quam, the bill is being laid over too, so happy to continue to work with Representative Ray Rauer and any member on this side who would like to. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if we could just get House Research to clarify, because my understanding is that the language from the current subdivision would not apply to this new proposed legislation.
Ms. Griffin, is that something you're able to weigh in on?
Chair Freiberg and Representative Davis, you're asking about the language of the amendment and where it's coming from. Am I understanding the question correctly?
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, yeah, we took the language from the amendment from the current Subdivision 8 in statute. If you have that before, it starts out, a township, municipal or county zoning authority may require conditional use or special use permit in order, .. Are you familiar with that language?
Ms. Griffin.
Chair Freiberg and Rep. Davis, yes. So the language that this amendment is modeled off of is specific to a provision in Section 462.357, Subdivision 8, that it applies to state-licensed residential facilities that serve a certain number of people or licensed daycare facilities. And then that the language was pulled from that subdivision, put in the amendment, and then specified to apply to the emergency shelter facilities.
Representative Davis.
Yes, so Mr. Chair, Representative Ray Rauer, to me it would make perfect sense to add in this language to the legislation that you're trying to add here. Thank you.
Yeah, just to comment on it, you know, I'm not, I am concerned that this kind of goes against the intent of the bill that Representative Ray Rauer mentioned. Personally, I'm not comfortable supporting it at this point. I do think this is language that can be worked on. I know Representative Ray Rauer is very open to working on it. I know you're a former council member yourself,
yes.
Aren't you? So you're very familiar with how these work. I'm not sure it would get support on my side at this point. Did you want to go forward with a vote on it or just, okay. Are any additional member discussion? Okay, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. So the amendment is not approved. Is there any additional discussion to the bill? Representative Ray Rauer, any closing remarks? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I didn't raise my hand quick enough. I actually have a question for Mr. Lightfoot.
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Lightfoot. Proceed with your question.
Thank you. I heard from the city and the experience of the city. I haven't served in city office, but I do represent the largest city in the state and the state that has that actually is building shelters and housing folks. I'm wondering if you know how many cities in Minnesota don't have shelters for folks who live in their communities.
Yeah, Daniel Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, I do not have that specific information on hand. I would note that there are a lot of cities, both within the seven-county metro area and outside the seven-county metro area, that have contributed significant resources both in addressing shelter capacity in their own individual communities and supporting organizations that provide services and resources to unhoused individuals to try and address homelessness concerns in their own individual communities. But I can certainly try to get back to you on sort of the overall footprint of shelters in this state. And, you know, nobody, including me, is disagreeing that we don't need more. We absolutely do need more shelter capacity. I think the concern is in terms of where shelters are sited. There are considerations when you open up all zoned areas in a city as a permitted use. It means that there's no ability for a city to address any incompatibilities that a shelter might bring to a different zoned area, which is why a conditional use permit for residential licensed facilities and other facilities that are being sited in other areas that are not compatible uses are very important, because a city can create certain conditions that, so long as that development meets those conditions, they can be sited in those areas without a variance or zoning change. And I believe that was the impetus of the amendment.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. I also just heard a shelter say that they looked at seven different sites and they were just turned down. And the thing about that I know about conditional use permits or whatever else is that they are being used, and we know this, to just keep out that kind of housing. And so there's a race to the bottom, it feels like. And I'm wondering, because the other thing I heard from a city perspective, it's hard because one city doesn't want to do it if other cities aren't doing it. What are your ideas or alternatives to make sure that every community can have access to a shelter? Because I hear you saying it's a priority, and then that you're against or you have concerns with this bill. What is the League of Cities doing to make sure that people can stay in their communities when they are unhoused?
Daniel Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, appreciate the question. I would say on a couple of fronts, in terms of, you know, understand the concern in terms of the concentration. And I think we would also share the concerns in terms of the concentration, but in a little bit of a different form. If you open up all of these areas as a permitted use without any ability for cities to impose spacing requirements, you do risk the potential for shelters to be concentrated in individual areas, as to not be, rather than being spread out into other areas of the city and other areas of the community. So I would love to continue to work with you, to work with the author, in terms of trying to figure out how do we find that balance between reasonable considerations for time, place, and manner of where shelters should go, what types of services they should be close to and have access to, you know, without swinging the pendulum so far in the other direction. I would also say Mr. Traynor talked about just the immense need in terms of resource to ensure that that individuals that are siting shelters and building shelters in communities across the state have the ability to have those projects move forward, and certainly continue to be a part of the advocacy community for more resources for shelter capacity as well.
Okay. Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Yep. Last comment, more of a comment than a question. I appreciate that. I think what we know is, and in Minneapolis, we have the safe, stable, home, stable schools initiative, because it's not just about the parents, it's about families. And what we know is our kids and our families are best if they're experiencing temporary homelessness, they're experiencing they're unhoused, is that they're in the communities, that their kids are going to school, that they work, that they have family. That is actually what's best for the family. And I really appreciate you bringing this bill, Representative Ray Rauer, both from your experience as a city leader, but because in situations like this, we oftentimes hear, you know, this is not the right solution. This is not the right solution, local control. And we're actually not doing anything to address the issue, which is people should have the right and the ability to be housed in their communities. And when we have shelters and others that are actually trying to do that, and the thing that's standing in their way is those rules and regulations, we should figure out how to clear the path, because I think we all agree people should be able to stay in their communities. And so I look forward to that conversation. I don't think that the answer is just to be opposed to things or just to say, and I agree with you, we do not want to concentrate. That's part of why we need this bill, is because otherwise what it's doing is it's concentrating in communities that have not done these restrictions. I think we want people to be able to live in the communities that then we're putting them back on that path to housing. And so, again, thank you for this bill. I'm glad we got to hear it in this committee. I am signed up to be on the bill.
Thank you. Seeing no additional member discussion, any closing remarks, Representative Rehrauer?
I just want to say thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to representatives for hearing and listening to the bill testimony. Thank you to Mr. Lightfoot also. We are meeting tomorrow, actually, to discuss the bill. So, you know, the hearing came a bit before our meeting, but happy to also work and reach out with you, Mr. Representative Davis, Representative Altendorf, whoever would like to work on maybe narrowing it just a bit and some amendments that will make sense to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rehrauer. With that, House File 1299 is laid over. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1596. Representative Akam, would you like to move that House File 1596 be re-referred to the General Register?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to make that motion, please.
Okay. Representative Akam has moved that House File 1596 be re-referred to the General Register. Please present your bill, Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a pretty simple bill, and I think we can all agree that it's a good governance bill that is looking just to expand who is considered a public official, and that will then give some transparency and access to personnel data. And so within the Met Council, it would be looking at the chair of the Met Council along with council members, and then upper-level, director-level staff within the Met Council. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnan. I am the Government Affairs Director at the Metropolitan Council, and I want to thank you for hearing this bill today. And thank you to Representative Akam for carrying this bill. This is a Met Council initiative. What the council is seeking to do here is to seek transparency and consistency with the Minnesota Data Practices Act. And just for a little bit of context, last year we had a situation at the council where one of our employees resigned, and there was a question about whether or not that information was if there was information available, and it turns out that this person was not included in the Data Practices Act. There was a lot of discussion related to this, and at that point we realized that under the statutory requirements of the Data Practices Act, the Met Council was not there. And so we're bringing this bill forward in order to make sure that we are being consistent and that we have folks who are in comparable positions, like state agency heads and deputy commissioners, would be included. We're asking for that, and also members of the board of the Met Council. So we're asking to be included. As far as staff, we have people, I'm sure, familiar with the council. If you're not, we've got our wastewater utility. We've got Metro Transit. We have our Metropolitan Transportation Planning Division, and then also our Community Development Division. This bill will also apply to the Chief of Police at Metro Transit and also our Chief Operator for the OEEO, or Employment Equal Opportunity Office. And so we enjoyed broad support in the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee, and I would ask for your support today in this committee as well.
Thank you for your testimony. We have one public testifier, Rich Neumeister. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Nice to see you again. Mr. Chairman and co-chairs, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Been around a long time. It's very much an anomaly to see a state agency pushing for its own transparency. And one of the reasons why is to give you some context of that. Almost 30 years ago, one or two state officials were very similar to the police chief of Metro Transit. He was being investigated, and then he decided to resign. Well, it didn't shirk right with some of the legislators at time, one of them being John Marty. So if you look at the law, you'll see where it says, where it begins on 1343, subdivision 2, and it'll show where it says public officials' investigations must be released if they resign and there's some other determinant. That's been law for 30 years. And then a similar situation happened when the school superintendents, because this law also applies to school districts. So there's a situation there in 2012. Well, at that time, Pam Myra, who you may remember, said, hey, we got to do something about that. So she met with myself and people from Nkoji, and that's where it's the local political people, as you can see in the law. But was missed was the Med Council, which is a political subdivision, but a public authority. So we're continuing on Sunshine, and for just ended Sunshine Week, for these kinds of positions. But I just share with you two things that you might want to keep in mind. One is that there are many other public authorities that have millions of dollars that they do that have a lot of impact on people's lives that are not under this law and that they should be. That would be a nice homework assignment if someone of an elected official so desires to do that. The other one, you have a similar bill in your committee now that, Mr. Chairman, as I spoke with you about earlier, it's House File 1917. And if you look in this same law, this was done 12 years ago, there were caps on cities and counties. And that's a bill that, again, for more sunshine and all that. And that also, they were both basically done in Sunshine Week. And so they're continuing to move for sunshine in government. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you. And I apologize for coming in and out of your committee. But sometimes when you wear a open government hat and a privacy hat, you've got to be two places at once. And I had to be, that's where I'm at now. So thank you very much for your time, co-chairs.
Thank you for your testimony. And actually, I think there is a chance the bill you referenced gets heard. Chair Quam and I have discussed it a little bit.
Thank you.
So is there any member of the public who'd like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Well, seems pretty straightforward. It's a good bill. I'm a co-author. As Mr. Neumeister said, I think it is pretty remarkable that there's a public agency asking for more public scrutiny. So I applaud the Met Council for doing that. Chair Akam, do you have any closing remarks?
No, I just thank you for the opportunity to present the bill today, and I ask for your support.
Thank you. With that, I will renew the motion that House File 1596 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is on its way.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
That's not mine.
Would you like me to move that House File 2361 be re-referred to the General Register? I heard a yes. The motions can always be amended, but that will be my motion for the time being. Yes. So thank you for going to the testifying table. Would you like to describe your bill, Representative Lee?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2361 before the committee today. This bill is an attempt to ensure that voters who typically only vote during presidential elections are redirected to the correct polling place. House File 2361 requires notice of polling place change or closure until the next general election or redistricting. I think I have an amendment also.
Yes, there is. I was going to ask you. There is an A1 amendment. It looks mostly technical. Is this just to put the bill in the shape you'd like?
Yeah, just clarifying. Technical clarifying amendment.
Okay, any discussion to the amendment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, the A1 amendment is adopted. Did you have further comments to your bill, Vice Chair Lee?
Just that this amendment clarifies that these notices would only apply to primaries, generals, and special elections, not school board elections, in case folks are wondering. With that, I have a testifier online.
Sure. Yes. Michael Stahlberger, I believe, is testifying. Could we just do a sound check just to make sure, can you hear us and can you say something to make sure we can hear you?
Yeah, sound check, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yep, we hear you and we see you. So please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Michael Stahlberger, Director of Property and Environmental Resources for Blue Earth County. My department is responsible for administering elections for about 40,000 registered voters. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. I'm representing the Minnesota Association of County Officials. MACO represents all 87 counties' auditors, treasurers, recorders, and finance officers, including elections administrators. MACO is a legislative platform and priorities listing every session, and ours is built on guiding principles. One of those principles is fair and impartial stewardship of elections. Another is continuous improvements to better serve our residents. While serving Minnesota's voters is a responsibility that our association's members take very seriously, and we work constantly to enhance the efficiency, administration, and security of elections. While House File 2361 potentially increases the workload for elections administrators, it also enhances voter efficiency. And for that reason, I'm here to express our association's support of the bill. We appreciate Representative Lee's efforts to bring this proposal forward, and we are grateful for her careful consideration of the language added to update the current law, as she just described. House File 2361 requires a large print notice to be posted, whenever practical, at a closed polling location, redirecting voters to a location of the new polling place. This notice may need to be in multiple languages, and it must be visible for motor vehicles, again, if practical. The notice is posted for elections until a presidential election or redistricting occurs. The secretary will provide an example for consistency statewide. The language being proposed is very similar to requirements for voter notification that's already required when a polling place is relocated in an emergency on or near election day. Election administrators work to establish polling places in buildings that are stable and long-term features of neighborhoods. These consistent polling places reduce voter confusion and frustration. However, circumstances do and oftentimes change between elections. For example, in Blue Earth County, one of our polling places decided to no longer host voters due to safety and security concerns. We ended up relocating that polling place just a half mile or so down the road to a suitable replacement. And from a customer service perspective, we placed signs at that polling place. Where it was located, directing folks to that new location. This bill essentially mandates that action, and we believe many of our counties and cities already do this from a customer service perspective. But in addition to the change of being posted at that location, now we're also being mandated to do it for multiple elections until that next presidential election or redistricting occurs, as was already mentioned. This is the part that creates additional workload at a time when election administrators are the busiest. However, we understand that not every voter votes in every election, right? And so we want to ensure that voters are going to see that sign at multiple elections leading up until that next presidential election when we do see our highest voter turnout. The provision about posting for redistricting is an important addition because it does allow us to stop that re-noticing requirement when redistricting occurs. Redistricting oftentimes changes polling places for many voters, and so those signs may actually be more confusing than they are helpful. Election administrators recognize that it's not uncommon for signs to go on red, right? Regardless of how well we design them or how large the print we make on the signs. However, we do want to always work in a way to ensure every eligible voter who wishes to cast a ballot is able to do so in an efficient manner. And attempting to reduce polling place confusion is always going to help that mission. A single voter who reads this posted notice is going to be one less voter who's going to call our elections office on a very busy election day. In closing, MACO supports the objectives presented in House File 2361 and appreciates your attention and consideration. We look forward to additional conversations on this subject and on any other elections administration items that we hope can be considered that address cost effectiveness, reduce administrative burden, and enhance voter understanding. I'll conclude my testimony. Again, thank you, Representative Lee, members of the committee, but I'll stay around for questions if there would be any. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lee, I'm just curious, Is this happening already at polling sites that have been closed? Are the election or the city or the municipality already doing and posting? Or this is something that they haven't done in the past, and therefore we need a law to make sure they do that?
Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thanks, Representative McDonald, for the question. So in current statute, the polling places will post for one election afterwards. And so that's why I said the goal of this is to make sure that we capture the folks who only vote during presidential elections. And part of this is also to make sure that we provide uniform guidance. And so this bill actually is arising from an issue that happened in my district and in a bunch of our districts where people who didn't vote in 22, and didn't realize that their polling place had changed, and also didn't vote in 23, right, and see that notice, showed up to a place in 2024 where, they expected to vote, and that place was closed. And so, often if enough people come back to a church that has shut down, they stick a sign up, right? But right now, there isn't uniform guidance on what that should look like. And so this is to make sure that, everyone receives the same amount of information and no more, no less.
Okay. Representative McDonald, follow up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Then, and I'm not belaboring this by any means, just it seems that the day where we have to put a sign up to notify voters that the polling place has been changed, it's up to the voters sometimes just to find out where they should vote. You can go to the Secretary's sites and vote, but that's fine. It's a bill I certainly can support. But under line 1.16, where it says, if practical, put up a sign at the closing place, if practical, stating where the new location is. And did you put that nomenclature in there because perhaps the polling place no longer exists? There's no building, and in that case, there's nowhere to post. But I find that the word, if practical, could give the assumption that you wouldn't put a sign up because it's not practical. Or how would you define practical, and why wouldn't it be best just to say place at the closing place, stating that the location has been a new polling place? Does that make sense? Just the impractical gives a way out of not having to put a sign up, but it's your bill, whatever you want. It just seems an odd
Representative Lee.
Word.
Yeah, so in the line right before that in 1.15, we're asking for large print and conspicuous place. So, a lot of folks in Minnesota drive. If you're driving by a place and you see the sign that, it's shut down, then you don't have to find a parking spot, get out of your car, walk over and see that this place has closed down. That's where the if practical applies to. So there should still be a sign, ideally, right, big sign that you can see from your car when you drive by.
Representative McDonald? Okay. Any additional questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Lee?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just grateful to have the opportunity to talk about this and make sure that, we get this to, the General Register because we are seeing an increased trend across the country of closing of polling places. And so, thanks.
Okay, thank you. With that, Representative Lee renews her motion that House File 2361, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion prevails, 1-0. Okay, sorry. Sorry, I was just talking too loudly, I guess. Voting too loudly. Representative Coulter, there's a lot of back and forth about this. I think maybe I'll just move House File 2284 be referred to the General Register and see where the conversation goes, and if need be, I can amend the motion. Welcome to the committee. You have an A4 amendment. Did you want to move that, or...?
Yeah, sorry. Let me get my act together here a little bit.
Sure.
We can do the amendment now, or it, why don't we just do it now and get it over with? So okay. I'll move the A4 amendment.
Okay. Representative Coulter's moved the A4 amendment. Any discussion?
If I could, bit of an explanation. So most of it is just sort of adding meat on the bones of some definitions that are changed in the bill. I did just want to point out from lines 1.14 on that this is new language. This is language that is in a bill that I am the author of. But it really, I think, goes in very much the same direction of the bill around
clarifying and making just making more accessible and more understandable what is and is not lobbying. And so this would also require the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board to publish a plain language lobbying handbook. And I, in my haste with everything else, I did not send out to the committee a fiscal note, but there is a fiscal note on the bill that shows no cost to the board. So this would not add any additional cost or any expenses for the Campaign Finance Board. So that is the amendment.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The amendment prevails. Bill is in the shape you would like. To your bill, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. So House File 2284 makes some changes to clarify laws around lobbying, and most of these are focused on lobbying as it exists at the local government level. Excuse me. You may all recall some time ago when we heard a bill regarding lobbying, and you may recall that I got a little bit worked up. And part of that is, frankly, because I've spent more time than I ever dared dream possible dealing with this particular area of state law. But I also got worked up because, you know, I think we all know that this matters. When we're talking about folks who are being paid a certain amount to influence the decisions that folks in government office make, that matters to folks. So just sort of by way of background, as you can see in the bill, the definition of lobbyist has basically two major components. The first is that a lobbyist is somebody who attempts to influence legislative or administrative action or the official action of a political subdivision. And the important point there is that this involves direct communication either with public officials or with people to encourage them to communicate with public officials that involves some kind of proactive action. Support this amendment, write an amendment to this, vote for this bill, vote against this bill, that sort of thing. And then the other sort of bigger piece there is that in doing those activities, a lobbyist is someone who either makes or spends of their own money more than $3,000. And that is really, I think, critical piece here because volunteers who are not paid are not lobbyists. A lobbyist is not someone who lobbies and makes more than $3,000. A lobbyist is someone who makes more than $3,000 lobbying. And we can get into how that works when it's a percentage of salary and so on. But I do want to make those important points just so we're clear about what a lobbyist is. So in our elections bill in 2023, we made some changes around lobbying. One was a bill that I was the author of, changing where lobbying laws apply for local governments. And we also added a definition of what it means, what an official action of a political subdivision is. And following that, there was a sort of mass realization of how lobbying laws apply at the local level. And I think also probably a bit of realization that folks who were lobbyists at the local level, but just didn't know it, probably should have registered. And so the following year, we made some clarifications. We delayed certain filings with the Campaign Finance Board, and we commissioned a study from the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board on those interactions and what changes in law may be necessary to further clarify and really get at the intent of what it means to be a lobbyist. And the bill that we have before us, with a few tweaks, pretty much consists of those recommendations from the Campaign Finance Board. So just briefly, it adds a definition and clarification in law for what it means to be an expert witness. It specifies that as long as this expert witness testimony is limited to public meetings or made available to the public, that they are not lobbyists. It clarifies that what I think already was the case, but was under some confusion, that local government staff that communicate with other local government staff are not lobbyists. It adds some additional municipal corporations that would be bodies that might require someone to register for lobbying. Most of these are special taxing districts, so bodies that have the authority to levy mostly property taxes, and other bodies that had the authority to enter into contracts, so bodies that could authorize the exchange of money. And then it also does streamline some language in the definition of what it means to be a public official and what it means to be a local official, so that there is not, or to hopefully reduce confusion around who is which, and that's mostly around the specifics of who has to file economic interest statements. So that is sort of the nuts and bolts of the bill. Happy to engage in the conversation.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have anyone who's signed up to testify. I see Mr. Sigurdsson's here. I imagine he could be called on if there are questions. Is there anybody from the public who would like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Coulter. I know that this has been yeoman's work all summer, and I mean before all summer, but I know there's a set of meetings that the Campaign Finance Board did, and those are just public ones. I'm sure you've done a lot of work on this. I had one place that I talked to you and the director about that I think I am hoping to either offer, I want to say it to the group, maybe just a simple oral amendment, but just to clarify the language on 3.2 that starts on 3.2, which says if communication occurs at a public meeting or is made available to the general public, and I asked, well, how would you make it available to the general public? And I think the intent, and from what I heard, the conversations leading up to this language were making it available, like written testimony at that public meeting. And so I think just to clarify, and because we oftentimes hear in this space, like more clarity is good. I am wondering, one, if you would be amenable to adding after the period to at the public meeting or at a public meeting. Just to clarify, I think that was the intent. We say at the communications occur at a public meeting or made available to the general public at a public meeting.
See, I imagine if we were to do this, the first step would be to get House research, since it didn't, there was no amendment offered, submitted previously, we'd get House research to state the amendment just to make sure we're clear on what it says. Then I'd want to confer with with Chair Quam just to make sure it's okay with, I'm sounding like it's okay, he's indicating it's okay, but we can revisit it if necessary. I guess maybe Representative Coulter, is this?
Mr. Chair. That certainly is the intent of the language, and I think I might have written it differently to make it clearer, but I think that's certainly the intent, and I would certainly accept that.
Okay, Mr. Gehring, are you clear about what the intent is, and could you state the amendment just so we're all in, so we and the public understand what's being discussed here?
Sure, Mr. Chair. So as I understand it, the proposed oral amendment would be on line 3.3 of the bill after public, insert at a public meeting. So that whole last clause there would read, if the communication occurs at a public meeting or is made available to the general public at a public meeting.
Okay. Representative Greenman, does that meet your goals here?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I had a hard time hearing. Could Mr. Gehring repeat himself?
Sure. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, committee members, so the proposed amendment is on line 3.3 of the bill after the word public, insert at a public meeting.
Okay, any comments from anybody? Okay, I got a general nod from Chair Quam that it was okay to move forward with this. So I guess I, with that, I will, all those in favor of the...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt you. Would it be okay? I'd like to make a motion for a roll call. What? Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Yes, on my oral amendment?
My apologies.
We could do a roll call on the oral amendment if you like, Representative McDonald.
That's what you get for paying attention to multiple bills at a time, right, members?
Yeah.
No, I'd like to make a motion to send this to government ops.
We are government ops.
Wait, what is my motion?
We need to vote on the amendment.
Representative
McDonald, would you be okay if we voted on the oral amendment that Representative Greenman offered first, and then we can revisit the motion?
Yes.
I think you might be telegraphing what you're intending to do later.
Mr. Chair, that is the correct.
Okay, all right. So this, with the motion is to the Greenman amendment, that adds the words at a public meeting on line 3.3. Any further discussion to that amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment's adopted. Would you like to call for division or anything?
Mr. Chair, are you... Okay. Can you embarrass me a little bit more, Mr. Chair?
No, that's... I would never do such a thing, Chair McDonald. So is there any further discussion to the bill or the amendment or any, say, motions that anyone would like to make? Okay, I'm not seeing any.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yes, we have several committees, state gov, and then you have state ops, state government. So I'd like to make a motion to send this to state gov.
State government finance.
Finance.
Okay. So I guess would this be a motion to amend my motion to re-refer? So the initial motion was to send to the general register. This would be a motion to amend the motion to send it to state government finance. Is that accurately state?
Mr. Chair, that is a very accurate statement.
Okay. Representative Colt, I mean, I know there have been, we have had some, my understanding is the Chair Nash, I know, had a bill dealing with lobbying. From what I understand, that did subsequently get referred there, but Representative Coulter, I know you did you care to speak to this motion? I feel like there are some other bills dealing with lobbying that didn't go there, and I'm still trying to figure out when bills need to go there. My assumption is that this committee handles issues related to lobbying. We have jurisdiction over the campaign finance board, so I'm not aware that it needs to go there. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding, and I did also, I have not had a chance to speak with Chair Nash, but I did have a chance to communicate with Chair Cleburne, who does agree that this bill does not need to go to state government finance. The jurisdiction of this committee covers the entirety, I believe, of Chapter 10A, which is the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. This entire bill is under Chapter 10A. I have had, in fact, a couple of other bills relating to lobbying, including the one that we amended onto this bill that were initially referred to state government finance. And when I communicated with Chair Nash, he told me that they did not need to be heard in state government finance, and we referred them to this committee. I haven't had a chance to speak with him, so I don't want to put words in his mouth. My understanding is that the decision to send his bill to state government finance was at his own request. I do not believe this does need to go, for those reasons, I don't believe this does need to go to state government finance. I would not support the motion. I don't think it's a necessary stop, given this committee's jurisdiction.
Representative Altendorf or Representative McDonald, did you want to respond to that first before I call on Representative Altendorf?
No, please call on Representative Altendorf first.
Okay, Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and Representative Coulter. I know you talked to me about this yesterday, and I was not aware of it. But since your bill and Nash's bill is very similar, and his was referred to state government, then that would be our recommendation that both of these are referred to that same committee.
Okay. Well, I'm just just trying to decide what's appropriate here. I know you can't ask a member how they would vote, but I am trying to figure out, you know, I think it would be, what's that? I feel like it would be better, you know, I want this bill to continue. I don't want it to fail in this committee. So, Chair McDonald, how strongly do you feel about the motion, I guess?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in speaking with Representative Nash at session today, he was asking us to see if we would, if you'd be so kind to have this re-referred to government, state government finance, and that is why. Representative Coulter, because the other bill also went to state government finance, he thought that this would be also a good stop. And I understand as an author, yeah, you'd like to get it right to the general register. We get that. I don't think this should delay it much by going through his committee first so it can be discussed. Ultimately, we'd like your cooperation and vote on it, Mr. Chair. But I think it would be in good prudence that it went through his committee as well. And Chair Nash, who worked so hard, did request it for us to ask that request of here. And with that, I'd like to ask for a roll call on that.
Representative Coulter, it is the it is generally the purview of the chairs to request bills, so I think it might be prudent in this case. I'm a little confused as to the jurisdiction myself in which bills need to go there, but I feel like it might be prudent to send it there if Chair Nash has indeed requested it. So your thought, did you
well, have a I guess I would say that I'm a little bit frustrated that Chair Nash did not approach me about my own bill. I would have been happy to have that conversation with him. As I said, I didn't have an opportunity to connect with him. I did, again, connect with Chair Cleavorn, who is his co-chair, and she told me specifically that it was not in the jurisdiction of that committee. That, to me, suggests there's perhaps a disagreement between Chair Nash and Chair Cleavorn about that. I mean, I understand the dynamics of the committee, and I appreciate that you know, you want to honor the request of Chair Nash. You know, as I said, I don't believe this bill does need to go to the State Government Finance Committee. This bill lies, like I said, entirely within Chapter 10A, which is the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. That is entirely within the jurisdiction of our committee. I do not believe, and like I said, Chair Cleavorn confirmed, that State Government Finance has jurisdiction over that particular chapter of state law. My request would be, and I can certainly make this to Chair Nash himself, would be that if he really feels strongly that his committee should hear it, we can always re-refer the bill from the floor. And if he believes that that is the prudent course, I can speak with him and Chair Cleavorn, and we can try to come to some agreement. And if we do, I would certainly support re-referring it from the floor. But my understanding, again, confirmed by one of the chairs of the State Government Finance Committee, is that this bill does not need to go through that committee.
Okay, I'm going to call a brief recess of the committee here. I'd just like to get a handle on some procedural issues here. So it'll probably be 5 minutes max. We're in recess. All right, I'm going to, the recess is over. Welcome back from the playground, members. I'm going to call the committee back to order. So after speaking with Representative Coulter and conferring with Chair Quam, I'm going to withdraw the motion to refer the bill to the General Register, and I'm just going to lay the bill over. So the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Coulter. There are two other bills on the agenda. They are both mine. I expect discussion to be brief, although after that last one, who knows? Yes, Chair Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we do have permission for a room this evening if these controversial bills take too long.
Okay. All right. I'm game if you are, Chair Quam. Just 1 second here. So House File 20, I'm just going to present them from up here, I think, rather than drag this out. So House File 2595, I think I will move that one to the General Register. Who knows? Maybe there will be a motion to refer this one somewhere else. So this was heard as part of the Secretary of State's bill. The bill provides, this version of the bill provides flexibility to allow election judges to initial either side of the ballot instead of ahead of issuing a ballot to a voter. The existing statute hasn't been updated since 1981 when we used several multicolor ballots. We deleted the word all, so the backs of all are struck. In the author's amendment, it makes clear that the allowance is to assume that the total of the prepackaged ballots is correct, still stands, and that election judges should initial ballots as they go. It might need some tweaking of language, but I think it's pretty non-controversial, and I know Nicole Freeman from the Secretary of State's office is here if there are any questions. Are there any questions to this bill? Okay. Seeing none, I don't think I need to have any closing remarks, so I will renew my motion that House File 2595 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Then House File 2596. thank you. Not only do we have recess, but there's also notes getting passed around. So it's like elementary school in many ways. So House File 2596. Chair Quam, I was thinking it might be good to have a bill in the Ways and Means Committee. What would you think if I move to refer this one to the Ways and Means?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that they are underworked at this moment, and it'd be good for them to have a little more activity.
Okay, sounds good. So this was also heard as part of the Secretary of State's bill. It updates the deadline to conform with the 84-day requirement throughout statute for when a county board must adopt a resolution to call a special county election question. So Nicole Freeman could discuss this if there are any questions as well. Are there any questions to this bill? Okay. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2596 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Any discussion? I'm sorry. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is referred. Chair Quam, that's all we have on the agenda before I motion to adjourn. Did you have anything you wanted to discuss about next week's schedule or anything? I know we're not meeting on Monday because of the Eid break, so the gavel will transfer to Chair Quam for Wednesday's hearing. I don't know if you wanted to say anything about it. Certainly no obligation to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What we're looking at is trying to have some omnibus, an election bill and omnibus government ops. And if there is discussion that you feel this should be included, and et cetera, I would say contact one of the chairs, and we'll have conversations. But there is a short runway to facilitate that, and being quick to feed us back your input would be useful. Thank you.
Any additional member comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, this committee is adjourned.